This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of April 11th. Off-season elections spell danger for the GOP. In a sign of brewing backlash against Republicans, a conservative backed by the wealth of Elon Musk suffered a resounding defeat in the race for a Wisconsin Supreme Court seat, while the Republican margin of victory shrank dramatically in congressional races in two deep red Florida districts. In Wisconsin, Susan Crawford defeated fellow Judge Brad Schimmel by 10 percentage points, allowing the state's high court to retain its 4-3 liberal majority. Donors poured over $100 million into the race, with Musk coughing up $25 million of that, making it the most expensive judicial contest in history. The world's richest man hurled himself into campaigning for Schimmel, wearing a Wisconsin cheesehead hat at a rally and saying, "The entire destiny of humanity turned on the outcome of the race." To juice turnout, he awarded two lucky voters $1 million each and offered $50 to anyone who posted a photo of a Wisconsin resident at a polling place. Democrats sued, saying Musk was buying votes, but Wisconsin's high court refused to hear the case. Still, Crawford prevailed. "Justice does not have a price," she said. "Our courts are not for sale." In Florida, Republicans easily won the House seats vacated by National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and former Representative Matt Gaetz. Yet, while those districts swung last year for President Trump by 37 points and 30 points respectively, Republicans Jimmy Patronis and Randy Fine managed only half those margins. Trump wrote on Truth Social that his endorsement of the two proved far greater than the Democrats' forces of evil. Musk's passionate support for Schimmel apparently backfired, said Reed J. Epstein in the New York Times. Thanks largely to his slashing of the federal government through DOGE, Musk is seen unfavorably by most voters nationwide, including 53% in Wisconsin, and the Crawford team benefited from making the campaign into a kind of referendum on him. The Trump administration is now saying Musk will step down as DOGE head, said Rachel Bade in Politico. The Washington hatchet man has become a political liability. The Democrats are celebrating, but the truth is the Republicans could have fared much worse, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Before this week, Republicans had only a 218 to 213 House majority, which made Trump nervous enough to pull New York Representative Elise Stefanik's nomination for UN ambassador so as not to risk losing her seat. But now the GOP has 220, thanks to Fine and Patronis, who won even though they were vastly outspent. Democrats are probably not winning in these districts for a long, long time. Yet the midterms aren't too far away, said Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post, and this week's results suggest that GOP turnout suffers when Trump is not on the ballot. What's more, the Wisconsin Supreme Court's liberal majority could soon help redraw the state's heavily gerrymandered electoral map, putting two more Republican House seats at risk. The Musk-led defeat is a flashing warning sign for Republicans in 2026. Outrage builds over mistaken deportations. The Trump administration admitted this week that it had shackled a Maryland father and shipped him off to a brutal prison in El Salvador by mistake, as concern grew that other immigrants were also deported erroneously. More than 200 Venezuelans and Salvadorans suspected of gang activity were flown in March to the Salvadoran facility, where shaven-headed inmates are warehoused in crowded, windowless cells for life and never allowed outdoors, after President Trump ordered their removal under the Rarely Invoked Alien Enemies Act of 1798. One of those caught up in the sweep was Kilmer Abrego Garcia, 29, a Salvadoran immigrant with a union job who has a 5-year-old autistic American son. In a court filing, the Trump administration conceded that Abrego Garcia had protected status barring his deportation and said he was arrested in error, but it claimed it could do nothing now that he was no longer in U.S. jurisdiction. In statements to the press, administrative officials continued to insist without evidence that Abrego Garcia was a member of the brutal and vicious MS-13 gang. Attorneys for many deportees say their clients were innocent and were arrested because of tattoos that the administration wrongly claimed were gang signifiers. Podcaster and Trump ally Joe Rogan highlighted the case of Andy Jose Hernandez Romero, a gay makeup artist who fled to the U.S. to escape persecution in Venezuela and is now incarcerated in El Salvador. "It's horrific," said Rogan. "People who are not criminals are getting lassoed up." As a political and moral matter, the government's case against Abrego Garcia is monstrous, said Andrew Egger in The Bulwark. "You can, like Abrego Garcia, have no criminal history and be married to an American. But if an ICE officer speculates that you might be in a gang, you lose all due process and end up in a hell prison in a foreign country forever. There is no defending this, which is why the administration is barely trying to." White House shills smear anyone who questions the policy as an apologist for brutal murderers, said Greg Sargent in The New Republic. "If Vice President J.D. Vance was capable of shame, he would be horrified that the administration has made such a chilling mistake. Instead, he falsely claimed that Abrego Garcia was a convicted MS-13 member. In reality, the government accused him in 2019 but never proved its case, and a judge ordered that he be allowed to stay. The longer Trump's Alien Enemies Act gambit goes on, the worse it will get," said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. "Look, closing the border is a win for the administration, which has done a commendable job reversing the incentives to migrate illegally to the U.S. But Trump can't just kick anyone out whose presence here displeases him. And his administration's claim that due process is satisfied even if the government doesn't give notice to detainees before deporting them is Orwellian. This is supposed to be a nation of laws." Free speech, the case of Rumeysa Öztürk. "Welcome to Trump's America," said Jonah Valdez in The Intercept, where you can be disappeared for writing an op-ed. If you haven't yet seen the chilling surveillance camera footage, Rumeysa Öztürk, 30, a Turkish Fulbright scholar at Tufts University, was walking to meet friends last week when masked federal agents seized her on a street in Somerville, Massachusetts, and whisked her away in an unmarked SUV. For nearly a day, no one knew where Öztürk was until she surfaced at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Louisiana. She is now awaiting deportation for activities in support of Hamas, according to the Department of Homeland Security, or as Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters, for creating a ruckus. Both allegations sound like references to last year's campus protests against Israel's war in Gaza, said Zach Beauchamp in Vox. Rubio said he's revoked the visas of more than 300 students so far, but unlike, say, Mahmoud Khalil, the green card-holding Colombia protest organizer arrested last month, the extent of Öztürk's ruckus appears to be an op-ed she co-authored in the Tufts Daily that calls on the university to divest from Israel. It says nothing that even approximates support for Hamas. State agents, in other words, abducted a legal migrant for expressing a political opinion, an attack on civil liberties that we would not hesitate to label as authoritarian in another country. Ozturk wasn't kidnapped or disappeared, said Rich Lowry in National Review. She was simply arrested. Yes, the ICE officers wore masks, a prudent measure given the doxing habits of the online left. But the agents treated Ozturk with respect and even kindness, one of them telling her, I understand it's scary. And no doubt it was. Some unpleasantness is inherent to any arrest, and unlike those grabbed off the streets of banana republics, Ozturk now gets a formal court hearing with ample legal representation and nothing to lose but her student visa. When the worst-case scenario is being free to go home to live your life however you please, these lurid comparisons to third-world torture regimes are grotesque and unfair. Her punishment isn't the issue, said Jeffrey Blahar, also in National Review. Yes, the Secretary of State has broad discretion to remove non-citizens from the U.S., but using that power to capriciously expel someone for expressing an unpopular opinion is utterly abhorrent and should be to all conservatives who claim to revere free speech. It sounds like there could be more evidence against Ozturk, said the Free Press in an editorial. Speaking to reporters, Rubio seemed to dismiss the idea that he'd revoke someone's visa just because you want to write op-eds. But if Ozturk did more than that, what was it? The administration's emerging pattern of detaining people for alleged crimes but not providing evidence risks eroding public trust in the rule of law. What if that's the goal, said Ayman Ismail in Slate. Week after week, arrest after arrest, the Trump administration is pushing the limits of the law and widening the circle of people with reason to fear persecution by the state for unspecified acts of speech or disloyalty. With the brazen state abduction of Ozturk, that circle now includes all foreign nationals, especially Muslims. Before long, it could be any of us. No one is safe, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Stunning and unprecedented things are happening in Trump's America in broad daylight on our formerly free sidewalks. The only consolation in Ozturk's shocking arrest is that we can finally stop talking about the threat of creeping authoritarianism, because tyranny is already here. It was a good week for active seniors after President Trump told NBC News that he is not joking about running for a third term in 2028. Although the U.S. Constitution limits presidents to two terms in office, Trump, who will be 82 in November 2028, said, "There are methods." It was a good week for lovers after Virginia was named the U.S. state best prepared to withstand an invasion by space aliens. Among other factors in Virginia's resilience, researchers cited the state's dense forest coverage and third-in-the-nation prevalence of military personnel. It was a good week for diversity and inclusion after the University of Maryland announced that Kermit the Frog, a puppet, will deliver its 2025 commencement address. Kermit's creator, the late Jim Henson, attended the university. UM President Daryl J. Pines said he was thrilled that graduating seniors will experience the optimism and insight of the plush amphibian. It was a bad week for transubstantiation after red spots discovered on a communication wafer at a Catholic church in Indiana were identified through biochemical analysis as a fungus and three different species of bacteria rather than, as initially rumored, the blood of Jesus Christ. It was a bad week for hard stares after two engineers with Britain's Royal Air Force pleaded guilty to destroying a fiberglass statue of Paddington Bear after a night of drinking. Sentencing the pair to community service, Judge Sam Guzzi told the servicemen that their actions were the antithesis of everything Paddington stands for. It was a bad week for gourmands, after Canadian tax officials included manatee meat on a list of U.S. products to be targeted with tariffs. Economist Jason Childs said the meat was likely listed as padding and doubts the price hike will create too much of a backlash from Canadian consumers. Montgomery, Alabama, interstate abortion. A federal judge this week ruled that Alabama cannot prosecute doctors or reproductive health groups for helping women travel to other states for abortions. Alabama's Republican Attorney General, Steve Marshall, suggested in 2022 that doctors recommending out-of-state abortion care should face criminal conspiracy charges. But Judge Myron Thompson ruled in a challenge from doctors that such prosecutions would violate interstate travel rights and the First Amendment, saying the state controls only what happens in its own backyard. Alabama has one of the nation's strictest abortion bans. The battle over New York Dr. Margaret Carpenter sending abortion pills to a Texas woman also intensified last week when Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton tried to enforce a $113,000 judgment against Carter for violating the state's abortion ban. An Ulster County, New York court clerk refused to accept the judgment, citing the state's telemedicine shield law. Washington, D.C., attacking the bar. President Trump this week upped his attacks on private law firms as part of an apparent campaign to punish his political opponents and legal adversaries. Wilkie, Farr, and Gallagher, which employs former Vice President Kamala Harris's husband, Doug Emhoff, agreed to provide $100 million in pro bono services to causes Trump supports. In addition to Emhoff, the firm employs an investigator for the Congressional January 6th Committee and a litigator who helped two Georgia election workers sue former Trump lawyer Rudolph Giuliani. Trump targeted five firms last month with executive orders revoking security clearances and access to government buildings, cutting contracts, and banning them from future business with the government. He rescinded two orders after the firms struck deals, but the other three firms resisted and won temporary restraining orders. Washington, D.C., all-nighter. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, shattered the record for longest Senate speech this week, holding the Senate floor for 25 hours and 5 minutes to protest President Trump's policies and actions. The record was previously held by Strom Thurmond, the segregationist senator from South Carolina, who spoke for 24 hours and 18 minutes in opposition to the 1957 Civil Rights Act. "These are not normal times in America, and they should not be treated as such," Booker declared as he began. He was cheered and aided by fellow Democrats, some of whom asked lengthy questions to give him a short break. Senate rules allowed him to accept inquiries, but before each pause, he carefully announced, "I will yield for a question while retaining the floor." His voice grew hoarse as the hours passed. Throughout the speech, Booker repeatedly framed his case against Trump as one of morality, not politics. "This is not right or left," he said. "It is right or wrong." Paris. Le Pen guilty. French far-right leader Marine Le Pen was convicted of embezzlement this week by a Paris court and barred from public office for 5 years, forcing her out of the 2027 presidential race that she had been leading. The court found that the national rally leader and several associates diverted about $5 million in European Parliament funds to finance their party. Le Pen, who is appealing the ruling, called the verdict political and vowed not to let the 2027 election be stolen. Judge Bénédicte du Pertuis said the court had to ensure that elected officials, like any citizen, do not benefit from any favorable treatment. Billionaire Elon Musk said the decision would backfire like the legal attacks against President Trump. Le Pen was also fined $108,000 and sentenced to 4 years in prison, although she won't spend time in jail even if she loses her appeal. Toronto, measles spreads. Ontario reported at least 102 new measles cases last week, lifting the Canadian province's total caseload to 572, higher than an unrelated outbreak of the disease in Texas. The hardest hit areas, including Mennonite and Amish communities, have low vaccination rates. Canada was recognized as having eliminated the childhood disease in 1998, but Ontario's chief medical officer, Dr. Kieran Moore, said health officials were concerned that the country could lose that status if it doesn't bring infections down by fall. The first case, diagnosed in October in New Brunswick, was linked to an international traveler. Infections spread to people who hadn't been immunized, some due to anti-vaccine sentiments, said Dr. Lenora Saxinger of the University of Alberta. It is so darn contagious, she said. Mandalay, Myanmar. Devastating quake. A magnitude 7.7 earthquake struck war-torn Myanmar last week, collapsing thousands of buildings and killing more than 2,700 people. They have to bury people with 10 bodies per grave, said Ai Mo, a resident of Saigang. Near the epicenter of Mandalay, 50 children were crushed at a preschool and dozens of monks were killed when a Buddhist monastery was destroyed. Shockwaves shook neighboring Thailand and a 33-story tower under construction in its capital, Bangkok, crumbled in seconds, killing at least 19 people. Rescuers have struggled to provide medical care, supplies, and emergency shelters in Myanmar, where a civil war has been raging since the military seized power in a 2021 coup. Rafah, Gaza. Mass evacuations. Israel pushed deeper into Gaza this week, ordering Palestinians to evacuate combat zones and saying it aimed to seize large sections of the Palestinian territory as security buffers and crush and clear the area of terrorists. Airstrikes pounded towns where supplies were already scarce due to Israel's blockade of aid, and the World Food Program said all the bakeries in support had been forced to close. Since Israel launched a new offensive against Hamas last month, its strikes have killed over 1,000 people, Gaza authorities said. The UN, in a rare assignation of blame, charged that Israel has targeted medics and ambulance workers last week and buried them in a mass grave. At least 15 medics were killed by Israeli forces while trying to save lives, said UN Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher. Israel said 9 of the ambulance staff were actually Palestinian militants. Taipei, Taiwan. Bodyguards were spies. 4 Taiwanese soldiers, 3 of them members of the presidential security detail, were sentenced last week to up to 7 years in prison for leaking state secrets to China. Their acts betrayed the country and endangered national security, the court said. Taiwan has seen a spike in espionage cases in recent years as Beijing has ramped up pressure on the self-governing democratic island, which China considers a renegade province. Days after the sentencing, the Chinese Army, Navy, and Air Force conducted joint maneuvers around Taiwan. The exercises are a stern warning and forceful deterrence against Taiwan independent separatist forces, said the People's Liberation Army. While visiting Asia last week, U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth pledged that America would reestablish deterrence to counter China's aggression in the Indo-Pacific region. Why Rogan wants respect. Seth Rogen swears he doesn't take himself too seriously, said Emma Bichol in The Guardian. But the 43-year-old comic actor, writer, and director can't help but get a little defensive when people dismiss his profession. I'm involved with an Alzheimer's charity, said Rogen, whose wife has lost several family members to the disease, and we go to a lot of galas. And I've been bothered by how little regard doctors have for what I do for a living. Yes, he knows he doesn't save lives. It's a comedically incorrect mental place to be, and I understand I'm wrong, but I would go home and say I feel I deserve to be on the same level as these people. Because if you make movies, you convince yourself you're doing the most important thing in the entire world. It's not true, but the illusion is very convincing. That self-belief and passion explains why arguments are common on movie sets. People really do scream at each other in Hollywood. Friction is just part of the process. To unwind, Rogan has taken up pottery and even hosts a televised pottery competition in his native Canada. He finds the clay-throwing world very welcoming and communal, and a refreshing change from Hollywood, where people are like, "How much money will I make from this interaction? And if the answer is not enough, I'm ending it right now." Coolidge's Bad Romances. "Jennifer Coolidge's search for true love nearly ruined everything," said Jonathan Dean in the Sunday Times of the UK. After being cast in American Pie in 1999 as the teen bedding Stifler's mom, the then 37-year-old actress suddenly found herself in demand. "I got so many good jobs in a row," says Coolidge, now 63. She appeared in the mockumentary Best in Show in 2000 and Legally Blonde and Zoolander in 2001. "It was the incredible wave. Then I sabotaged myself." She turned down jobs so she could pursue relationships with men who she now realizes were unavailable or really hate women deep down. Her moment of movie glory seemed to pass. "I was deeply depressed for a very long time. Then in 2020, she was cast in HBO's The White Lotus and won critical acclaim for her portrayal of a naive, unstable heiress. Her career is now back on track, and so, perhaps, is her love life. Before the show, she recalls being approached in New Orleans by a man who had a T-shirt on that his belly came out of, plus red cowboy boots. He was 4'11" and said, 'Would you like to go out?' There was nothing wrong with him, but you should have this idea that Brad Pitt or whoever will sweep you off your feet." She smiles. "White Lotus changed that for me. It's not just that little guy anymore." The head of a charity co-founded by Prince Harry accused the British royal of harassment and bullying at scale this week after he and other trustees quit the organization, citing her untenable leadership. Sophie Chandauka claimed she received no advance notice of the Duke of Sussex's resignation from Certa Bale, launched in 2006 to help young HIV patients in Lesotho. A Zimbabwe-born lawyer, Chandauka alleged that UK-based trustees had resisted a move to shift more decision-making to Southern Africa. She also claimed to have rejected a request by Harry that she speak up in defense of his wife, Meghan Markle, over negative media coverage. "Not because I didn't care about the Duchess," she said, "but because we are not an extension of the Sussexes." Some trustees said they didn't recognize the allegations and that Chandauka's almost dictatorial style was to blame for their departure. Kanye West ramped up his offensive against his ex-wife Kim Kardashian this week, telling an interviewer that he regrets having four kids with the Skims founder. "I didn't want to have children with this person after the first 2 months of being with her," said West, who wore an all-black KKK-style hood and cloak while speaking to DJ Academics. "But that wasn't God's plan." West, 47, recently turned on Kardashian, 44, after she tried to block the rapper from releasing a song featuring their 11-year-old daughter, North, performing alongside alleged sex trafficker Sean Diddy Combs. "This white woman and this white family," he told Academics, "have the control over these highly influential black kids that are half the children of Yi. Rachel Zegler, the star of Disney's live-action Snow White remake, hurt the film's box office with her immature pro-Palestinian and anti-Trump comments, the son of the film's producer said last week. The movie took $42 million in the U.S. during its opening weekend. The live-action The Little Mermaid made double that in its first 3 days in 2023. In a since-deleted Instagram post, Jonah Platt, son of producer Mark Platt, wrote that Zegler, 23, dragged her personal politics into the middle of promoting the movie and said his father had to fly to New York last year to reprimand the actress for posting Free Palestine on a social media thread about the movie's trailer. After the November election, Zegler wrote that she hoped President Trump and his supporters never know peace. She later apologized and said she let my emotions get the best of me. Fighting against fluoride, a growing number of communities are ending water fluoridation. Will public health suffer? Why do we add fluoride to water? Because it helps keep teeth strong, replacing minerals that are lost during regular wear and tear. Grand Rapids, Michigan became the first city in the world to add fluoride to its public water in 1945. Within 11 years, the amount of tooth damage from decay among the city's children had dropped by 60%. About 72% of Americans served by public water systems now drink fluoridated water, and the process is estimated to save about $6.5 billion in dental costs annually. Fluoride is the perfect example of helping people without them even having to do anything, said Dr. Srinivas Koka, former dean of the University of Mississippi Medical Center's School of Dentistry. But an anti-fluoride movement has been gaining steam in recent years, with more than 170 communities across the U.S. rejecting fluoridated water since 2010 over health fears. In Florida alone, at least 24 cities and counties have ended fluoridation since September. Last week, Utah became the first state to ban the addition of the mineral to public water, with Republican Governor Spencer Cox claiming there isn't sufficient evidence to require people to be medicated by their government. Is fluoride dangerous? Too much fluoride, a naturally occurring mineral in soil, water, and rocks, can be a bad thing, causing skeletal fluorosis. But to develop that extremely rare bone weakening condition, you'd need to consume more than 30 times the fluoride normally found in fluoridated water. Without clear scientific evidence of harms, opposition to fluoridation was long rooted in conspiracy theories. In the 1960s, the far-right John Birch Society claimed fluoridation was a communist mind control plot. The anti-fluoride campaign moved from the political fringe to the mainstream amid the pandemic, part of a wider backlash against public health measures. In the days before the 2024 election, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an anti-vax activist who is now health secretary, called the mineral an industrial waste and vowed the incoming Trump administration would recommend its removal from public water systems. The movement has been further supercharged by recent research suggesting risks to children from higher levels of fluoride. What does that research say? A study in May found that women who had higher levels of fluoride in their urine during pregnancy were more likely to report that their children went on to experience temper tantrums, suffer anxiety, and complain of headaches and stomach aches. Our results do give me pause, said study author Tracy Bastain of the University of Southern California. Pregnant individuals should probably be drinking filtered water. But some scientists called the study flawed, noting that it involved a small sample of 229 women and relied on a single urine sample taken once during pregnancy, which is not sufficient to prove true fluoride overexposure. A few months later, A report from the Federal National Toxicology Program that combined data from 74 studies concluded with moderate confidence that higher fluoride exposures are consistently associated with lower IQ in children. The report didn't quantify the exact effects, but some of the studies showed a drop of a few IQ points with exposure above 1.5 milligrams of fluoride per liter of water. While that might seem like a bombshell finding, many researchers say the paper should not worry Americans who drink fluoridated water. Why not? Critics note that more than two-thirds of the studies examined were deemed by the report's authors to have a high risk of bias, undermining their reliability. More importantly, most of the data dealt with exposure levels far above those common in the U.S., where the Department of Health and Human Services recommends 0.7 milligrams of fluoride per liter, equivalent to about 3 drops of fluoride in a 55-gallon barrel. Only 7 of the studies looked at children whose drinking water was below 1.5 milligrams per liter. In those studies, there was no relationship between IQ and fluoride. The science is not as strong as it's presented by the report's authors, said Stephen Levy, a dental public health expert at the University of Iowa. Despite those problems, the report's contents were given substantial weight in a September ruling from a federal court ordering the Environmental Protection Agency to address potential risks from fluoridation to infants. Are there alternatives to fluoridating water? Critics say the wide availability of fluoride toothpaste and mouthwash means there's no need to add the mineral to public water systems. But the Centers for Disease Control argues that a combination of fluoridated water and dental products containing fluoride provides the greatest protection against tooth decay, and fluoride advocates say dental products aren't accessible to everyone, especially low-income Americans. Many kids tell us that they don't even have their own toothbrush, said Dr. Scott Tomar at the University of Illinois Chicago, who runs school-based dental programs. What happens without fluoride? Dentists warn that ending water fluoridation will lead to a decline in America's dental health. That's exactly what happened in Buffalo after the city quietly stopped adding fluoride in 2015 while upgrading equipment at a water treatment facility. Few residents knew about the change until a local newspaper reported on it in 2023. Local dentists said it explained why they had seen a sharp rise in cavities among the city's children in recent years. What always gets me, said Jennifer Meyer, a nurse and professor of health sciences at the University of Alaska, is that the anti-fluoride activists aren't at the bedside while that kid is getting a procedure to deal with extensive tooth decay or an extraction or full mouth reconstruction in the operating room. But healthcare, public health, dental professionals are. How tyranny can coexist with normalcy. We are witnessing the birth of a dual state, said Aziz Hook of The Atlantic. Through its radical reinterpretation of federal law and appointment of officials more loyal to MAGA than the Constitution, the Trump administration is cleaving off a domain in which the law does not apply. Migrants are deprived of due process and shipped to foreign prisons, while January 6th rioters are given pardons and praise. Ordinary spending responsibilities become tools to punish foes, while allies are rewarded with generous government contracts. It's worth remembering that the Nazis began with a two-track system, a capitalist economy governed by stable laws for most Germans, and a domain of lawlessness and state violence for Jews and other supposed internal enemies. Of course, a dual state need not end in genocide. Look at Vladimir Putin's Russia. And it need not spark mass opposition, since the lawless domain may not touch the lives of most citizens who can turn away while dissidents and scapegoats lose their political liberty. That doesn't mean favored citizens are safe. History shows that once the lawless state is built, it can swallow anyone. Signalgate, downplaying a security breach. The Trump administration says it's moving on from Signalgate, said Gregory Smirnovsky in Politico, even if others aren't ready to do the same. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt announced this week that the case has been closed on the scandal, which began when The Atlantic's editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg revealed that he'd been mistakenly added to a group chat on Signal in which top Trump administration officials discussed plans for a U.S. military strike on Yemen's Houthi rebels. As Signalgate swallowed multiple news cycles, President Trump reportedly considered firing his national security adviser, Mike Waltz, not for organizing a chat on an unsecured private phone app, but for the crime of accidentally inviting a liberal journalist. Ultimately, Trump decided to keep Waltz rather than gift a scalp to his critics and declared the scandal old and boring. It's anything but, said Bill Press in The Hill. Administration officials endangered the lives of American troops by splashing around secrets that could give a huge advantage to the enemy. Heads should roll. It's a horrible cliche, but the cover-up really was worse than the crime, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Waltz, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Vice President J.D. Vance, and others in the chat were guilty of a careless failure of operational security and an equally careless cleanup. If the administration had just apologized quickly, the scandal would have soon died. Instead, Trump, Waltz, and others kept it alive with wild defenses, suggesting Goldberg had somehow added himself to the chat and that the information shared, including the times of bombing raids, was of little significance. Still, no Americans were harmed by Signalgate. So it seems absurd to demand the heads of Waltz or Hegseth when you consider how many recent bloody geopolitical disasters, the George W. Bush administration's Iraq debacle, Joe Biden's deadly Afghanistan withdrawal, did not yield resignations. But we don't actually know that there were no ill effects, said Mike Nelson in the Dispatch. Adversaries such as Russia, China, and Iran are unlikely to suddenly announce that they've hacked the phones of U.S. national security officials and are monitoring their signal chats. And we don't know how many other high-level administration meetings have taken place on Signal, possibly with the awareness of foreign intelligence services. That the Trump administration is treating none of this as a problem does not augur well for American security. Continuing to rely on the luck of leaders who refuse to exercise good judgment is a fool's game, one we're bound to lose. Bird flu jumps to a new livestock host. The world's first case of bird flu in sheep has been detected in the UK, adding to the long list of mammal species the disease has evolved to infect and raising fears that it could eventually become transmissible among humans. The H5N1 virus was found in a single sheep on a farm in Yorkshire, northern England, where the whole flock had to be tested after birds on the farm fell ill. The infected sheep was immediately killed, and authorities said they took strict biosecurity measures to contain the outbreak. It's not clear whether the virus can yet pass from sheep to sheep, as it does among cattle, reports the Financial Times of the UK. In many of the other mammal species affected, pigs, cats, coyotes, foxes, bears, rodents, raccoons, opossums, and seals, there's some evidence such spread is happening, but it hasn't been seen in humans. Of the 70 people in the U.S. known to have been infected so far, most were dairy and poultry workers, and all apparently contracted the virus from animals. But the more species the virus evolves to infect, the higher the chance of a mutation dangerous to humans. Meera Chand, a microbiologist at the UK's Health Security Agency, says it is not yet time to panic. Current evidence suggests that the avian influenza viruses we're seeing circulating around the world do not spread easily to people, she said, and the risk of avian flu to the general public remains very low. Social media's anti-placebo. Don't Google the side effects. An Australian study shows that social media can worsen the nocebo effect, the placebo effect's opposite, in which people are more likely to feel adverse side effects if they are told about them. Several earlier studies had documented the nocebo phenomenon. In one, people who were warned that a drug they were taking could cause erectile dysfunction were disproportionately likely to experience it. Another found that headaches at high altitude were more prevalent in people who had been warned of them. The new study looks at how suffering that may be psychosomatic can spread easily over social media. A surge in cases of facial and body tics, including whistling, clicking, and clapping, was driven by TikTok videos, for example, and people who saw posts about COVID vaccine side effects were more likely to report adverse reactions. Online information can spread nocebo effects faster and further than has previously been possible, psychologist Kate Faze of the University of New South Wales tells New Scientist. This is quite scary, given how many people seek health information on the internet and through social media in particular. Will it all end in a big crunch? Something's up with the cosmos, reports the Washington Post, and scientists aren't entirely sure what it means. We know that the universe began expanding with the Big Bang some 13.8 billion years ago and that the expansion started to speed up around 5 billion years later. We'd named the indivisible force pushing that along dark energy. But now new data is in from the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, a telescope system near Tucson, and it suggests that dark energy has actually been weakening over the past 4 or 5 billion years. If that proves correct and dark energy isn't the cosmological constant that we previously assumed it to be, then all sorts of alternative cosmic futures become possible. The universe could speed up again or settle down into steady expansion. Or if the dark energy decays so much that gravity replaces it as the dominant force, the entire universe could collapse in a big crunch. Whatever happens, the end won't come for billions or trillions of years. Still, the findings highlight how little we really understand about the cosmos. I think the universe is giving us a lesson in cosmic humility, says Nobel Prize-winning physicist Adam Riess from Johns Hopkins University, who wasn't involved in the study. It doesn't seem to be following the manual we had. Obituaries. The heartthrob who was king of the miniseries, Richard Chamberlain, 1934 through 2025. At the peak of his youthful fame, Richard Chamberlain was said to get 12,000 fan letters a week. Most were from young women smitten by his wholesome good looks and his portrayal of an idealistic young intern in the TV drama Dr. Kildare. The show's 5-year run ended in 1966, but Chamberlain proved to have staying power. He established himself as a serious stage actor, then in the 1980s rode a second wave of TV stardom that earned him the tag King of the TV miniseries. He played a shipwrecked English navigator imprisoned in feudal Japan in the critically acclaimed Shogun of 1980, and a Catholic priest tormented by illicit love in the phenomenally popular The Thornbirds of 1983. Over his 6-decade career, Chamberlain played a broad range of other TV, film, and stage roles, from an abusive husband in Petulia, 1968, to Aramis in The Three Musketeers, 1973. "If you're just going to play one role all your life," he said, "you might as well be selling insurance." He grew up in Beverly Hills, where his father was a salesman of supermarket fixtures and prone to periodic drinking binges, said the Los Angeles Times. Chamberlain majored in art at Pomona College, but overcame his shyness to turn toward drama. After a 2-year army stint in South Korea, he returned to L.A. intent on being an actor. He scored some small TV roles, but was a virtual unknown when cast in Dr. Kildare, which made him a star overnight. After the show ended, he moved to England, determined to shake his pretty boy image by training as a serious actor, said the New York Times. He earned strong reviews in stage roles, including Hamlet, which he called a career game changer. Returning to the U.S., he moved between stage and screen before Shogun restored his major star status. "For decades, the gay actor was reticent about his private life," said the Times of the U.K., fearing that coming out would damage his career. But that changed when he published an autobiography in 2003. In later years, out and proud, he played gay characters in shows like Will and Grace and Desperate Housewives. Having spent his early years consumed with homophobic self-loathing, he said coming out was a profound relief. 68 years it took me to realize that I'd been wrong about myself, and now suddenly I'm free, he said. It's intoxicating. I'm not afraid anymore. The author who started the teen vampire craze, L.J. Smith, 1958 to 2025. L.J. Smith gave the world a taste for teenage vampires. The author of the Vampire Diaries series, which has sold more than 5 million copies, began writing the tale of a girl caught in a love triangle between two blood-feeding brothers in 1990. Inexperienced in negotiating, she signed away rights to her work for just a few $1,000s, not knowing that the cultural passion for high school vampires would reignite years later. When her publisher started churning out ghost-written Vampire Diaries books, Smith went around traditional book channels to keep control of the narrative. "I wanted to finish the story," she said in 2014. "So many people still wrote to me constantly saying, 'Can you just tell me how it ends?'" Raised in Southern California by an engineer and a teacher, Lisa Jane Smith started writing her first novel, The Night of the Solstice, in high school, but spent several years as a teacher before committing herself full-time to fiction. She chose to model her pen name after her two favorite fantasy writers, J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, said People. The Night of the Solstice sold only 5,000 copies, but it caught the attention of the publishing imprint Alloy Entertainment and led to the first three Vampire Diaries books. The following decade, the Twilight series ushered in a vogue for sexy stories of vampires more toothsome than toothy, said the Telegraph of the U.K. Smith published another Vampire Diaries trilogy from 2009 to 2011, and it turned into a cultural sensation when the CW network picked up a TV adaptation. But Alloy dropped Smith when she refused to recycle storylines from the TV show, and it kept publishing Vampire Diaries novels. Incensed, she took to Amazon's now-defunct Kindle Worlds to publish her own novel and novella in the series. Readers warred with each other online as to which should be regarded as canonical, and Smith won out. "An indefatigable writer," said the New York Times. Smith kept working as she went in and out of hospitals after being diagnosed with an autoimmune disorder. Before she died, she had reportedly completed Night World, another YA series, as well as a new post-apocalyptic novel aimed at adults. Many of her teenage fans from the 1990s, she noted, had helped hook a new generation on Vampire Diaries. It's nice to hear people say, now I can share it with my daughter. The Battle of Britain pilot who kept coming back to fight again, John A. Hemingway, 1919 to 2025. John A. Hemingway had a knack for survival. The last known member of the few, the honorific bestowed by Winston Churchill upon 3,000 World War II pilots who staved off a German invasion in the Battle of Britain in 1940, was nearly killed a month into the campaign. An enemy aircraft shot his Hurricane fighter over the English Channel, and as engine oil flooded the cockpit, Hemingway ditched the plane for the jellyfish-infested sea. A friendly rowboat found him and took him home. He had another close call 8 days later when he was forced to land while pursuing a German bomber over southeast England. The British Home Guard was there to greet him. I could speak reasonable English, he joked in 2018, so they didn't shoot me. Born in Dublin, Hemingway enlisted in the British Royal Air Force shortly before the war broke out, said the Guardian. He was in combat by the spring of 1940 and took his first German bomber in May while stationed in France. But his luck turned the next day when anti-aircraft fire downed his plane. With two leg injuries, the pilot joined a group of refugees limping toward Brussels before finding his squadron. Hemingway later served as a flight controller during D-Day, but he soon returned to the air. In 1944, Germans took out his Spitfire over Italy, and once again he was rescued, this time by local farmers, who disguised him in peasant clothing and smuggled him to the British lines, said the New York Times. Despite his escapes, the war took a toll on Hemingway, and he dealt with the pain silently. During the war, all my closest friends were killed, he said, and my memories and thoughts about them I have always regarded as a private affair. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.